You're listening to Raising Anchor, a Rhode Island FC podcast. We're glad you're here. Hello, and welcome to Raising Anchor, your podcast and source for all things Rhode Island FC. I'm your host, Matt Intrican, coming to you on Thursday, April 11th. RIFC holds the line in a dramatic 0-0 draw on a cold and wet night, and we'll explain why this was some of the most important soccer they've played so far. Plus, we'll get you ready for the week ahead as RIFC enters their first busy week of three games to play as they start by taking on the Pittsburgh Riverhounds, who are coming to town and also looking for their first win on the season and to get themselves out of the Eastern Conference basement. To help me cover all of this and more is co-host Jason Carey. Jason, how is it going, my friend?
Not too bad, buddy. Just getting over being sick, you know, just in time for the next RIFC game this Saturday.
Would you say that your health was eclipsed this week?
I don't know. I didn't check it out. I didn't care that much, to be honest. I'm not going to lie.
Did you, I looked at it for all of 5 seconds and then, you know, I don't have the patience to watch a full eclipse. It's like, oh, look, it's moved a little bit. Oh, it's moved a little bit more. It was interesting, though, to like kind of look around and the animals were all kind of acting a little differently. And it felt like you were all of a sudden like shifting into like a darker scene in the middle of the day. But other than that, I didn't really see the hoopla. A bunch of people like were traveling up north, further north to see this, you know, phenomenon. I get it. You know, it's 40 years till the next one, but
I heard they got stuck in major traffic coming back and didn't home the next day till like 3 a.m.
Oh my gosh. No, I mean, between that and the bridge, there's just no way. Speaking of the bridge, how's that new commute? They've readjusted the lanes. I haven't done it yet.
It's only right now. It's only one way that it's changed. And because we don't know how to drive in the state. So it's not doing too much. You know, when they add the other lane on the other side, we'll see how that changes things. But right now, it's same old, same old.
I Googled to my work commute today because I almost went in and it said it was 52 additional minutes. And I just put my sweatpants back on and worked from my desk here at the house. So we've got that going for us. But enough talk about traffic, enough talk about solar phenomena. Let's get into what matters, and that is Rhode Island FC news. Your boy, the Aussie, Jackson Lee, earned his first team of the week in week 5 as the goalkeeper on the team of the week. I mean, you knew this was coming. Not only did he have the clean sheet, 1 of 2 on the week, with the most saves, with the most flair, with the most Aussiness. I mean, this man was destined to be on that scorecard for the week.
Yeah, I mean, have you seen that mustache? We almost got him to win save of the week too, but the Sacramento fans that came in hard?
Yeah. So, I mean, listen, fans that are just getting into this is going to be a popularity contest. There's a reason they actually do like the public vote, and then they have a media vote that allows people to use data and scientific observation to make those decisions. When we see one of our players end up on this, in fact, I would say Jackson Lee probably had the second best save of that list. I think the Las Vegas keeper had an outstanding block to the top corner, but the Sacramento save was just like he just stuck his foot out. I was like, okay, like move along. It's a popularity contest. We're too new, I think, in our infancy, and you know Sacramento was drawing 20,000 people. They were trying to make an MLS push, right? So
yeah,
it's understandable that they're probably gonna dominate those kinds of contests at least in the interim. Speaking of a popularity contest, though, Rhode Island Monthly is having their voting for best of everything for Rhode Island for the year, and there is a podcast poll in there.
Nice.
So, just like we said with our motif, we didn't win or we didn't get invited, so I'm assuming we didn't win, but the same thing goes if you go into that poll, and at least they do it pretty interestingly. You can enter whichever columns you want. You do not have to vote for everything. And then you can enter in your details and like lock in your vote with your email and your first and last name. So if you scroll way down in the Rhode Island Monthly columns, you'll see that favorite podcast. If you feel so inclined, we've got a lot of great fans and supporters who help this podcast out. And if you want to go to Rhode Island Monthly and enter in Raising Anchor as your vote, feel free to do so. We always will appreciate your support and we're always grateful for everything that our fans do for us. So that's, I guess, our shameless plug of the night.
Yeah, go for it. It'd be cool. Or not. We won't lose sleep over it, but we'd appreciate it. So do you have to legally disclose that you work for the club now? What happened here?
So I wouldn't say some of the big news internally for us this week is I will be guest appearing for the stadium production, for the stadium operations, and I'll be filling in for the PA announcer role this week for the match against the Pittsburgh Riverhounds. So you'll hear my voice just as you hear right now. You'll also hear it over the stadium PA this weekend. It's not a permanent job. At least it hasn't been explained to me that yet. I should say it's more of a, you know, there was an opportunity. There was a schedule situation with the other PA announcer and they asked me to fill in. So we'll see if this opens up more doors in the future. But all I'm hoping right now is that I can contribute to a positive experience on game day and maybe own my own personal flair where it's appropriate and obviously also above board. I'm sure Rhode Island FC personnel listening to this tomorrow are like, whoa, 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 Matt's going to go rogue.
Hold the phone, Matt. Calm down.
But, you know, I think it's fair to say with no ill will towards the previous announcer so far and probably the person who may, you know, come back for the next game after this if this doesn't become permanent for me, you know, there's a little bit of soccer discrepancy. I think I've heard from fans, I've heard from people around the stadium like, oh, you know, there's a couple things that we'd like to see, you know, done. Like you don't say the minute of, you say the minute that you're actually already occupying.
Yeah,
that was a big notice.
It's already happened.
Right. Right. So some small little things like they're great. They've all been great announcers, but maybe not so much that they've been aware of and familiar with the sport of soccer. So at least in my one effort so far, I hope I can bring that. And who knows, maybe I'll make a complete joke of myself and you guys will all get to enjoy that as an inside joke for those of you that listen to the podcast and follow the club as robustly as you do. So
what it means is I'm impartial and you are nitpicking and biased.
Yeah, so if I become the voice of Rhode Island officially, you have to become the voice of truth. You'll hear me quickly on every podcast just, you know, defend them no matter what. That's how they got into it, right? They bought the podcast out by just offering labor. So there you go.
Yeah, like that guy who keeps emailing you. I guess we are just shills, right?
Speaking of, did you, not shills, that's a terrible segue, but did you see the video of the Providence City Rogues versus the New York Greek Americans for the National Amateur Cup?
Yeah, I saw that and I wasn't sure what I was expecting. I was kind of surprised to see an amateur team drive that far and then be like, no, we're not playing. Like, I don't know what was going on there.
Well, so there's some, it's kind of becoming a conspiracy theory really quickly where they're claiming that they couldn't play because of the conditions of Pierce Field, which is crazy because that was at one point supposed to be the potential home for Rhode Island FC during its temporary year instead of the likes of Bryant. I live right by that field. That field is in no way, shape, or form a tough field to play on in terms of the quality. It's not obviously, you know, playing at the likes of Camp Nou. But that being said, it's perfectly serviceable for an amateur game. The Providence City guys were great about saying, like, is this because some of their players couldn't make it up and they knew they'd lose the cup? So they had to find a way to derail or to delay. Lots of different conspiracy theories going out there. But to your point, like to drive 3.5 hours up to then just not play a game, like that's insanity. What we don't know yet, though, is if this was a true forfeit as of this recording or if a reschedule will happen. But if this game is rescheduled, I really hope that the supporter group, the Defiant 1636, shows up to support Providence City. And because there's no like actual rules or security, they just sit behind the New York Greek Americans and just blast them with
just
music.
Just
don't even let them think. Don't let them communicate to each other. Just rip them apart with music and with partying. Like that would be such a great way to support another club, you know, here in Rhode Island when it comes to soccer. But like you can't make this kind of stuff up. Like we're getting ready to prep for an Open Cup, and on top of all the Open Cup drama that's happened this year, now there's National Amateur Cup drama. Like you can't make these kinds of storylines up.
Only in Rhode Island.
So speaking of Open Cup, this is where it starts to get interesting for us, right? We've got 7 days ahead that we will see 3 games from Saturday to Saturday, with the inclusion of 2 away games with both the Charlotte Independence game on Tuesday the 16th and then the Las Vegas game the following Saturday. I'm super excited. We're not going to get a chance because if we did this tonight on this podcast, we would go 3 hours. Knowing our track record, this would be a Lord of the Rings-esque level of length to talk about two different opponents plus a recap.
Return of the King?
Is that the longest one?
Possibly. That's the last one, I think, right? So
I just know that, like, I remember there's a fun fact about that you can watch all 3 of them and it can take 16 hours. But having said that, we are going to partner with the Quahog Corner and FQB and possibly Matt Kerwin from RFC Nation. He's on vacation, but he's kind of loosely committed that he'll jump on a phone call. So we are going to be on Monday night's open Twitter space with FQB, taking time to break down the Open Cup, give a kind of detailed report on the status of Charlotte Independence, maybe also do a recap live of the Riverhounds. Typically, FQB's Twitter space is just more of like an open forum for fans to listen to the rants and then kind of add in their own takes. But we're going to hijack this Monday's upcoming one, and we're going to do the ranting so that you guys can all listen. We're trying to see if we can get some additional guests to jump on. It's more than likely probably not going to happen at this point because it's just a little too late, but you never know. So we're going to be collaborating with the likes of the other podcast personalities that are covering Rhode Island FC. So if you want to follow along live on Monday, you can do so. And if you don't want to follow along live, the Twitter space is usually recorded afterwards, so you can listen to that at a later date. And of course, go and support our other personalities that are in the space. They're working just as hard as us. Give them the love. Give them the same support that you give us.
And yeah, so we have a watch party for the game coming up against Charlotte Independence, and that will be at Moniker Brewing in Providence. Word on the street is that there will be another collaboration between the club and supporter group, so expect this place to be popping.
So, question for you. Are we going to win this Open Cup? Like, how invested do we need to prepare mentally? We haven't gotten a win yet on the regular season. We're about to enter Open Cup territory. Are we need to get as jazzed up as possible for this, right?
Yeah, we got it. Nailed on. Coach said that he will respect the competition and that he wants to try and win any competitions that they're in. So I think we will go for it. With it being our first, you know, schedule of what, three games in seven days, I would expect some rotation. Maybe we get to see some more of the kids who we haven't seen play too much. That being said, I imagine, you know, we're going to go for it.
We'll talk about that more before the end of the episode, because I think some of what you just said will be absolutely dependent on the outcome of this game this Saturday, right? Because,
yeah, I guess depending on how it goes, two nights from now, you might kind of change up your idea about how you want to approach that game, because we're still looking for the first win.
Yeah, we don't want the first win to be, I mean, if it comes to the Open Cup, we need it to be the first win to advance, but we really want the first win to come this weekend against the Riverhounds.
I think you would obviously want your first win to be at home in front of fans, but at this point, for like momentum and just to kind of get it off the monkey off your back, as they say, you get it however you can take it. So if it doesn't come until, you know, next week at the Open Cup game, I mean, I think that it will be good for the club regardless.
So let's get into the games themselves. So we're coming off of a 0-0 draw, which, you know, is the universal laughing stock joke that American sports fans will typically make when taking a shot at soccer, right? Like, I spent 90 minutes to watch a 0-0 game, and that's supposed to be exciting. But at the same time, that's the beauty of a sport like soccer. You know, I always harken back to when people watch baseball and they say, what's a perfect game? A perfect game is when a pitcher strikes out every batter. There's no hit. And when you think about it, for the person watching that, that's going to be one of the most boring games to watch, that many strikeouts. Like, are you kidding me? Like, that's not a fun product. But yet it's so important and significant to the technicality of it. A 0-0 can be, for all intent, the same thing as well. And that's exactly what we saw on the night. Do you remember, I didn't get this until I went back to the notes. Do you remember when I joked last week when we were talking about score comparisons that I would rather see a 0-0 than a 3-2 like blowout on either side, because I wanted to see this team show up defensively?
I think I vaguely recall something like that, yeah.
I need to be more careful with the power that I command now. Clearly I have the power. But that's exactly what we saw. We see this 0-0. We see it in some of the worst weather that the team has faced so far, so much so that even Coach said during the press conference after the game that he made them practice in the similar weather earlier that day because they had not yet practiced in that, you know, quote unquote, perfect New England weather, aka waterlogged and windy and cold. And so, you know, you see all of these, I don't want to say stars aligned, but these were not favorable conditions. We're coming in against a very hot Charleston Battery. We expected that this was going to not only, you know, dampen the players, but also dampen our spirits. And that's not the case. That's not what we had going on for the day.
Speaking of the weather, I had heard that they had some trouble getting here. Their flight got delayed, and on top of that, there was a women's lacrosse game that kind of ran late, so they didn't get any practice before the game.
You're talking about the Battery?
Yep.
Yeah, we did see that. We got there pretty early, and they came in straight to the locker room and then were out. And yeah, there was zero time to acclimate or acquaint themselves to the pitch, to the dimensions. Like, they came in just like ready to, I mean, and sometimes that's what professionals do, right? Like, we often think like they sit there, they like measure the grass, they like study the wind, and they just show up and kick a ball. But they had no chance to get ready to the conditions that they were put forth on that day. And on top of that, we didn't know this at the time because we weren't paying attention to the future schedule, but Charleston Battery had a, and I hate to say this, but a much bigger game looming on their conscience with the Louisville City coming into Charleston, playing at home in front of a packed crowd for their first ever national TV broadcast. So you had Louisville sitting at the top of the table and you were home with the national TV rights. Like, you know, there was probably a lot of things going on their mind in addition to being delayed, having bad weather, not really knowing what they were going to expect with this Rhode Island FC team. That's got to make things difficult for a traveling team.
Yeah, we didn't look at that. But at the end of the day, you can only play who's in front of you. And, you know, you can't think about all those other things going on, because in the same regards, you know, there are things that our team is going through. So at the end of the day, if we, you know, look at trying to use these as excuses, the weather, oh, they showed up late, etc. You know, I don't think it takes away from the performance that our team put out there.
Right. But I have to ask, you know, as explosive as Charleston has been, did these attributes, you know, plus this weather, did this provide us with a conservative Battery team, in your opinion? Like, we looked at the stats, we had this conversation kind of offline before we recorded tonight. Did the Battery play conservative to pace themselves, or did they show up that well and we just held our line?
It's hard to say. I do think it's a little bit of both. I don't think that they showed up here and thought, it's raining outside, we're not going to try and win this game, let's just sit back and, you know, defend. They definitely had a few opportunities on the night. I just think that, you know, we made some adjustments, and, you know, it's silly to say that one team wanted it more, but I think we had more to prove out there than they did.
Agreed. And, you know, and you look at this team, so the Rhode Island FC group, they line up in another 3-5-2. At this point, I don't think the 3-5-2 is going away. I don't think it was a decision on the players made available, at least at this point in the season. This seems to be at least the one that Coach Kano wants to see this team get as familiar with as possible. So we see them line up in a 3-5-2. Lee makes a return to the net. And that is because Koke, it was, you know, day to day at that point, and a decision was made to have Lee remain in net. I think that's a huge call no matter what, because that tells, as a coach, that tells that player, like, hey, we have the confidence, we have the faith in you that, yeah, you had a bad game in Tampa. That necessarily wasn't your fault. That was a team effort or a team loss. And we believe that you have the ability to step up and, you know, captain this team from that net side. Not captain in terms of the roster, of course, but just manning that net. And then we see the biggest change, where we see Clay Holstead continue his center back performance, but now this time on the right side of that pairing, back to what we saw in his highlight tapes with Columbus Crew 2, more of that right back, right center back side. And we see the introduction of one Gabriel Alves, who we'll talk about in a minute, and he's shoring up that left side. And that is primarily because we find that there are late minute scratches and the loss of Karifa Yao and Grant Stoneman due to injuries, and they weren't available on the night. So those were the big changes. The rest of the formation remained the same as the week before, with Stephen Turnbull, Connor McLinn, Joe Brito, Mark Ibarra, and Jorge Quisera in the center line. And then your striker pair up front with Noah Fusan and Chico. I have to, like, we still haven't seen Holstead return to the midfield. And I understand the necessary reasons why, because of the lack of losing two center backs on the night. But before we knew about those injuries, because remember, we saw the formation, we didn't hear the injury report until the game went live. Was that you scratching your head saying, was this coach experimenting more, not knowing that it was actually due to injuries? Or were you just like, Clay Holstead is going to be a defender for the rest of the year?
Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't sure. I just figured there was some sort of tactical reason as to why he wanted to do it. I mean, as much as I want to see Clay in the whole in the midfield, he continues to perform, you know, very well wherever coach decides to put him. So it's hard to kind of challenge that at this point.
Right. So those were the introductions. Those were the players to watch. But before we move further, because this is going to be probably one of the largest talking points on the night, and I really hope, Jason, I really hope this does not start to become this like ref complaint segment. We've talked about the ref performance on each match, but I feel like the more we progress this season, the more we are nitpicking and breaking apart ref performance versus player performance. I really hope that this trend stops. I don't know if this is just the luck of the draw with some of these refs that we've had so far, but by no means was this probably the worst ref experience we have had all season. And I say that in the sense of the consistency and lack of really, you know, owning and managing a match when it comes to refs. So Joshua and Carcione, I don't even know where to begin. This guy, he called 47 fouls on the evening. I had never looked at this stat before because I didn't know that I needed to. And Carcione went from like seventh in the league to third in only three matches. He's actually under indexing by two matches, and he's now in third place for the total number of fouls called per match and total fouls called per game, or excuse me, for his entire season so far as a ref this year. He's taking the lead in all of the wrong indicators that a ref shouldn't have. He calls 47 fouls on the night. Again, didn't know this until I did the research. Did you know the average match has 22?
That makes sense. I don't always look at that stat, but I can't ever recall seeing a number as high as 47. I feel like it's always usually somewhere between, you know, like 15 and 30, which would make sense as to the average. You said like, what, 24 or whatever?
Yeah, it was like if they bumped shoulders and if someone just lost their footing, there was a foul being called. We saw 25 fouls for Rhode Island, 22 for the Charleston Battery. Seth, the ref, his first comment when he sent his email evaluation on the night was that he was consistently inconsistent. I'm pretty sure, you know, using Seth's words here, I'm pretty sure Seth would have issued a red card on this ref for the performance on the night.
You know, we do talk about the ref a lot. They can be major deciders in the game. But up until this point, you know, with the exception of like a call here or there, I don't think any of those refs had bad games. But this ref definitely did have a bad game here. I don't know if he was just trying to control the game, but just didn't do a good job of it at all. I don't know. It was a very frustrating night for the team. We should have kept all of our players on the field, but, you know, it kind of is what it is at this point.
And it's so interesting. I've heard in the bigger leagues that there are refs out there with personalities that like try to insert themselves as a character or a story on the night. And then there's sometimes just reps that make a mistake and that makes them infamous for one reason or another. I feel like at this level of play, that shouldn't be happening. Like, there's no reason to gain notoriety at the USL championship level when it comes to your quality of reffing.
It shouldn't. Remember the other day we were watching the Real Madrid and Manchester City game, and the commentators actually had said, oh, this ref is letting the game flow and letting the players go out there and play. He's not making it about himself, which is unfortunately seems like some refs out there, even in, you know, the Premier League and the Champions League, they kind of, you know, try to be the star of the show.
Right. And what's, I think, just kind of to double down on that or make it even more frustrating is not only was there a high number of fouls called, which really disrupts the flow and the consistency of a plan of attack of a game style that either team is trying to, you know, kind of unfold on the pitch. It didn't seem like there was consistency in the number of fouls as well as the balancing on the books. I know that there's no set number that equals, you know, X amount of fouls will equal a card. But when you have 4 of 6 Rhode Island yellow cards issued in the first 31 minutes, and then you only see 2 additional ones, one in stoppage time, and then, of course, Connor McGlynn's second yellow, which we'll talk about in a bit. And then you see that the Charleston Battery have almost the same amount of fouls on the night and only 1 yellow card. It just strikes me as, what is going on with this team? What is going on with the impression of this group? Because I know that there's a difference between the accumulation of persistent fouls, tactical fouls that will eventually get you in the book, and then there's the more challenged ones like a reckless foul, which seems to be what our players are accumulating more than that other type of foul collection, if you will. But when you get to 22 fouls on a team and there's only 1 yellow card, I got to say, again, from the consistency perspective, it didn't look like this ref was really holding the teams accountable for their decisions, so much so that when we went back and looked at the index of fouls conceded, all of the players that got booked, they had less than 2 fouls on the night that were, you know, again, conceded. So they were bad fouls, potentially. But on top of that, it's like they didn't really play as aggressively as this hype is being built up about this team right now. They played through what they wanted to play through. And I think Coach said it best. You know, you asked this really great question when we did the press conference. You asked that, you know, RAFC just appears tougher, right? That, you know, we play through the fouls, we play through the challenges, whereas other teams tend to kind of fall down in this league so far and try to draw out the contact or the collision. You know, are we getting a bad name for ourselves? Like what Coach Cano alluded to when you asked him the question during that conference?
Yeah, I don't know. It's possible that this ref brought a bias into the game and maybe had heard that we play a rough and physical game. So he thought that he needed to give some cards to try and quote unquote contain us. Whereas the other, you know, or the battery, how do you only get 1 yellow for 22 fouls? I mean,
they had 4 players, by the way, that had at least 3 fouls or more. 2 players had, one player had 4 fouls, 1 player had 5 fouls.
I mean, like, it's possible. I didn't review the tape and go back and watch everything.
I did.
But I think it is highly unlikely that at least not one or two of their other players will pick up a foul. I mean, I've even seen sometimes when a team is trying to persistent foul, but they're being smart about switching who it is, and the ref catches on to him like, hey, I know what you're doing. You're just trying to slow down the opponent, waste time. They will just give out yellow cards to stop it. So, but I mean, you know, this ref was consistently inconsistent. So I just kind of don't know what was going on in his head.
We also seem to get punished a lot on 50-50 challenges, I've noticed. These are 2 games now where Chico's been put in the book as he's making a play on the keeper, collides with the keeper in a place where the keeper has no ability to control the ball. The keeper's coming out. You know, he's not like contained in the net and just getting bulldozed. They meet, and both times, you know, it's been, in all honesty, a 50-50. And I get it. Sometimes there's this effort to protect the players like a goalkeeper. But at the same time, both times they're single incidents each game, and he gets put in the book for those. Connor McGlynn's second yellow, a 50-50 challenge. It could be more borderline yellow carded for that. You know, I understand why the ref called that. But at the end of the day, like, you can't just look at the size of someone's body and say, oh, there's a physicality there. He dominated that contact. He dominated that challenge. And so therefore he needs to be punished because he's the more physical player of the two. Like, I'm starting to question some of the contact purposes in this league.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. But I mean, I've even seen, you know, fouls and contact in higher level play in the Champions League and Premier League, where bigger players will go down and, you know, it won't get called a foul, even though just because they are a bigger guy, that doesn't mean that you can't trip up the momentum or, you know, push them down. These are all athletes. They do have some level of strength.
So this isn't a question on what Cano should do. This is a question: if you were running this team right now, would you start to tell our players to fall? Not to dive, but like when they get hit. No?
No,
even if it works against us, because it looks like it's working against us right now.
It does, but I think that you know, if this team is still new in terms of, you know, playing together. So what, we only played 4 games still. I would rather to see them maintain their style. I would, you know, sit down and say, hey, look, keep playing physical, keep attacking, but also we have to be smart and not get everyone sent off. So there are times when, you know, maybe you need to hold back a little bit. It like with most things, it's in life, it's finding a balance.
Yeah, but this team has that ability. I mean, with the exception of Connor, the people that committed their fouls in the first half of the game, they all sat on a yellow for the rest of the game and didn't make a mess of it.
So sometimes when they're committing fouls, it's because they gave the ball away in a bad spot, right? As the team gets better, they find those passing lanes, they get better at receiving the ball, not under hitting that pass. You're not putting your teammates in bad positions, forcing them to make those challenges. So I think some of that will go away. I still think that there you can still play as a physical team, and I don't want to say play with honor and not, but because, you know, fouling is part of the game.
Are you a Narragansett Lager now? You're made on merit, made on honor?
But, you know, I wouldn't say all of a sudden like, hey guys, it's time to just go diving, because that's whatever.
I'm not saying diving. I'm just saying when they take the hit, you've seen this team shoulder it and try to weather through so that if they can win the ball, whether that's through an advantage or just like, there seems to be more fight in this team that they won't fall down on the slightest contact, and that doesn't seem to be the equation that I've seen every other team that they've been lined up against do.
Part of that comes down to the tactics. If we're ahead 2-0 and they foul you, like, yeah, you can take the foul and go down, but we've been chasing games, you know, with the exception of going ahead against the Rowdies.
I don't think we've been chasing games. Outside of the New Mexico United game, we've gone up.
I guess it's not the right term to say chasing games, but like we've been going after it in the sense of, you know, at 0-0, they still want to go out there and win the game. They're not, oh, it's the 48th minute, let's bunker down and defend this one point we have. They were going after the win. I just don't think it's in their mentality to kind of play that way. You know, if it's the 90th minute and you're up 1-0, yeah, you take that foul and you fall down. But outside of that, I just don't think this team is built that way.
Okay. So let's talk about the Connor McGlynn fouls real fast. I'm going to paraphrase what Seth the ref wrote in. We're still trying to figure out how to get you on the pod, Seth, so patience. But Seth writes in, I watched... So Connor McGlynn had 3 fouls on the night. The first foul was given to him, and then the next 2 equaled yellow cards. So in the first foul, I watched this over and over. I still do not know how this is a foul. From what I can tell, Yakaza checks his shoulder and sees Connor coming. When Yakaza gets the ball, he takes one touch from Connor and spins. At the same time, Connor challenges for the ball, and it looks like Connor trips him, but there's no contact that's made evident. And because of the way the ref's vision was kind of obstructed on this, the only thing that they can assume is that due to the spin, you know, it looks like there was contact, but it's not clear and obvious. So there's that first foul, which Seth is already questioning as that probably shouldn't have happened. The big one, though, is, and we talked about this live from the Crow's Nest when we saw it, Connor's first booking was when he went through that slide tackle like it was a FIFA game. That's Seth's own reference. You're going to ask for trouble when you slide like that, like it's a FIFA game. But the problem was is that Connor slid, missed the ball, and missed Aaron Malloy completely. But he stayed on the ground, and as Aaron Malloy tried to dribble around Connor, Connor starts to do this like breakdance spin. So he's trying to come back around and stop Malloy from advancing down the field. And as that happens, Charleston sees the leg out and, you know, quote unquote, falls over it. And Carcion didn't have a view because there were players blocking his view. He did see Connor slide through. He sees Connor like flailing around like a crab on the ground on his back, and then he sees a player just trip and fall down. And I think the ref just he bought the act, he bought the performance on that. But you know, that was not a foul. He didn't make any contact at any point, and we even said so during watching it live.
Yeah, sometimes when you go to ground like that, players will try and just trip over you or initiate the contact by kicking you. So you just got to be careful. That being said, I don't think the foul should have been called there, but you know, it's this ref. What are you going to do?
Right. So, and then the third foul and the second yellow, which is probably the most likely the real yellow that Connor deserved. McGlynn is late. He jumps late. He collides with the player from Charleston. It's still a like close call because Connor McGlynn is a giant of a man. So he's only a second off from it, but still, like, it wasn't anything where it looked like he was just trying to play the player and not the ball. He just doesn't get it. And they land, and Dos Santos flies off. He like just bounces off of McGlynn and you know, it's deemed reckless. I think that, and I understand the need or the propensity to control a game and make sure players don't get hurt. But again, this is more of just like body types working against each other. I don't think that in any way, shape, or form, Dos Santos was hurt from this. I don't think it was as reckless as possible. I do think that if McGlynn hadn't been on a yellow yet of any kind, that is worthy of a first yellow. But I also don't think that that's a send-off. To me, this was more of Encarnacion saying like, hey, I want to be the star of this show. I want to control the narrative, and I want to send this player off right now. You know, it's our captain. I think this is worthy of a first yellow. I don't see this being worthy of a second yellow, and I don't think it's red worthy. What are your thoughts on it? This seems to be really decisive in both camps of fans for Rhode Island FC right now. What's your take?
Yeah, I don't think if we're looking for consistency, right, when you say, oh, it shouldn't be a second yellow or a sending off, it kind of should be either a foul or not. And then from there, is it a yellow card foul or is it, you know, a red card foul? I thought it was a foul. I didn't really think it was a yellow card, but also from where, you know, I didn't have the, you know, the best position to see it, and I did not go back and rewatch this foul. So if Seth, the ref, said that this is more of a yellow, then
Seth is saying this is the most likely to earn one because of the contact. But they're both in the air. There's no elbows out. There's no one like trying to like hit in like a head or go head to head. It's just late aerial contact. To me, I think this is just like, again, if we start calling for 50-50s like this simply by body type, this is a dangerous precedent to set in the league because we have very big players on our team.
Yeah, I think it should have just been called a foul and you just move on. I don't think there should have been any card attached to this, but you know, Encarnacion is gonna just do what he wants at this point. So I'll be curious to kind of look at the stats. The next game, if he refs this weekend, I want to see how many cards and fouls he gives out.
I've built a ref tracker and I'm starting to track all of them. We'll talk about the ref we're gonna have this week and why that may be more of the same problem. But we'll nice. We'll get to there. We don't want to focus on the recap first. So let's talk about the actual game. Again, we're not going to do like the breakdown of like what happened in this minute, what happened in that minute, because the fans that are listening to this, they know. They watched the game. They were either there struggling in the rain or they watched it at home and they got the best view possible. I will say, speaking of that broadcast, though, they cut out the top of the broadcast tower to get rid of the poles. And those poor cameramen were just sitting in the rain, having to wipe the lenses. Like, there were multiple complaints now, like, why are there raindrops on my feed? Well, that's what happens when you get rid of the awning that was with poles covering.
We're just trying to give them the real New England experience.
So let's talk about this. It was a 3-5-2, like we said. I mean, in reality, I saw a 5-3-2 for a majority of the night. You could definitely tell that the order on the night from Coach Cano was that the wingbacks did not ever overextend themselves and that they remained tucked in to keep that opposing offense contained as much as possible. It kind of seemed that like this time around, instead of everyone moving up, they would allow at most, you know, like if Turnbull moved up, Quisera would stay back and vice versa. So it felt like there was a lot more focus on shape and the tactics there versus like, hey, we're going to be high offense, high press, just go get the ball and go do whatever you need to do to score a goal.
Yeah, it did seem like they were trying to, I don't know if this is the right term, but like press zonally. So if the ball was down on the right-hand side where Stefan was, you would see maybe a midfielder come or even the center back behind him kind of help press as well as a striker. But the rest of the team would kind of try and keep their shape as well as marking their opponents. And then as the ball would move through the field, they would kind of try and move back into position. We saw them be a lot better in terms of keeping their shape this game, as well as, like you said, not overextend and try and protect those wings right behind the wing backs. Because in the other few games, we kept getting hit back there and giving up our opponents a lot of chances on the wing.
So do you think this is how Kano envisions his 3-5-2 from the beginning of the season, where it's putting the lads into that tighter clustering, that tighter formational coverage? Because we didn't, again, you know, people said last time that the midfield was absent. I think it was just more that the midfield was pressed too high. This time, like, the back line was still playing at the halfway line a majority of the time on offense. We just saw better connections, and like, it was very central. It was very kind of crowded, actually, centrally this time. I didn't see as much of the disconnect when it came to those midfield and defensive composures. Is this what Kano had envisioned from the beginning, or was this adjustments to what he has seen after Tampa?
I imagine this is not exactly what he envisioned. You know, I don't know how many of these players have actually played, you know, a similar 3-5-2 kind of system. But I imagine for quite a bit of them, it is an adjustment. And I think that they're trying to find that balance. And in the first three games, you saw that balance swing too far to the attacking. And in the second half of the Rowdies game, like, we were just absolutely punished for it. So he kind of I think is kind of correcting that kind of, you know, they went a little bit off the rails. He's trying to get them to find that right amount. Because there are times when, you know, I imagine he maybe just wants to let them just go out and attack if it's appropriate, and if it's working in their favor and the other team is not putting them under pressure.
Right. And let's get honest with that pressure, by the way. It goes both ways. While this team was defensively sound on the night, it wasn't without the needs from keeper Lee putting in a tall order on the night himself, standing on his head for a majority of the game. With those six saves, including three that were not just, you know, shot directly at him, but full extension saves, as Rhode Island FC weathered 12 shots, which were pretty consistent, and it was 5-1 and 7 on the other side. So it's not like, you know, the defense was immaculate in protecting Lee from having to do defensive work himself. But all in all, like, this team showed that they can get it done when it comes to having a complete defensive game. Offensively, things were a bit quieter. You know, the first half only had 4 shots with 0 on target. Chico definitely tried to play a different type of game, as the midfield wanted to stay connected to the defensive line more than that offensive side. You saw him constantly trying to challenge that offsides leverage, if you will. He got called out on it a couple times, rightfully, and then I think there were a couple times that he had taught the refs, the line refs, that, like, hey, I'm going to do this. And if they questioned their own judgment, they were like, I'm just going to play it safe and assume Chico was offsides again. But with the view we had, there were 2 times where he was completely still on sides. It wasn't lethally far enough advanced to, like, maybe make something of it. But I think he was giving those ARs a run for their money, because he was constantly challenging that offsides line. And then we saw, you know, Noah Fusan, for I think the first time in his set of games, not get shut out of the game, but he definitely wasn't able to kind of penetrate that final line of the Charleston defense as much as he probably would have liked. So, you know, you see an improvement on the defensive side and maybe a little bit lacking on that offensive side as they go into the second half. I want to say this now, but I was really impressed with how they adjusted in the second half. You know, you saw a mostly defensive performance, and with very little to show on that offensive side, and whatever coach did to make those adjustments or those tweaks out of the players, you saw them claw back. And again, they didn't have a bad night on either side of the halves, but you saw them start to go for it more on that offensive side in the second half. You start to see the game kind of open up more in Rhode Island FC's favor. Jackson obviously had to continue making saves with an additional 3 saves in the, or 4 saves actually, in the second half. With 1 in the stoppage time that, like, kept the game nil-nil for all intent. But then, you know, you saw the likes of Chico continue to stretch the defense. And then, of course, Joe Brito, who everyone's been bagging on, he goes and, you know, rifles a shot from deep in the midfield, and it hits the crossbar in, like, what was the 68th, the 69th minute. The crossbar is, like, our best friend, in the sense that it is our worst friend, and it keeps getting on our way of scoring goals in front of our fans and our crowds.
Yeah, the crossbar and the post hate us. I think all the players actually want to win that challenge.
Is someone giving them, like, the California taco like unlimited tacos for the month and we just don't know it?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's in their contract.
They probably have like a player pool bet in the locker room that says, oh, you got it this time. Here you go.
Yeah. And so not to take away from Jackson Lee's six saves, but I do think that defensively we limited them to, you know, not high quality chances. Neither team on the night put up very good XG. Joe Burrito's was the best chance that we had on our side. I don't remember from theirs, but their total was not very high considering they did have more shots than us. So they were just trying attempts and, you know, Jackson Lee was, you know, bailing us out there.
Well, Jackson even said it in his press conference that even though he gets to go in the record book as the keeper with the first clean sheet in club history.
Yeah, it's a team effort.
Right. And he made sure to call out everyone that helped him get there, you know, and that's, let's get honest, that's the way soccer should work. If your defense can put in a 90-minute performance and they stop 30 promising attacks and they are able to misdirect or redirect three threats, and then your keeper saves the one that actually ends up on target, like that's literally the definition of good soccer, right? So you love to see it. They did a great job. I am so incredibly proud that they took what was probably so far, I mean, it was their first and worst loss of the season, and they didn't let that get them down coming into the next game in front of the fans. They could have easily said, hey, Charleston's going to be just, they're just too good right now, and we're going to be cagey about it. They didn't do that. Like, they came out, they said, the first thing we're going to do is control the defense, and we're going to control the tempo, and they did exactly that. They didn't even need the ball at all times. I mean, Charleston dominated the possession in this game, which, it depends on how you look at it. Rhode Island FC's not out to have possession, but they clearly were comfortable not having the ball as much as they normally have in previous matches. They were huge. Alves, Gabriel Alves, man, my guy here, he finally gets his first start, and not only did he help with the clean sheet, but he also got Defiance's man of the match. And the craziest thing is he was the only backline defender that stayed out of disciplinary trouble, and he found 12 opportunities to pass into the final third on his second highest pass for the team on the night on 35 passes. You know, we've talked that we wanted to see this guy in action. His ability to thread balls to the likes of a far-reaching Quisera or a Fusan waiting in the wing, like he saw passing lanes that I didn't see, and I had the God, you know, view from up above. And I was like, where's this ball going? And he was huge on the night. So major props to Alves, well-deserved. I hope that this is nothing but momentum for him to argue to continue to earning a starting spot. But the other thing I want to make, kind of take the lemonade out of the lemon that we got, the grit on this team was incredible, not just because of the Tampa Bay result, but when Connor McGlynn left the field, there were 20-plus minutes still left in this game, and this team did not look like they were ready to give up. They did not look like they needed to conservatively, you know, just defend. They were still pressing. They were still going for the attack. And I don't want to say this as a demerit against Connor, but like the game plan didn't really change when he was taken off the field. Like, yeah, they had to rotate some players to compensate. But like, I didn't, you know, sometimes you can feel when you lose that one player or you lose that one body, it's like, oh man, like these are not going our way. I didn't feel like that really changed as much. I feel like we lost offense more so than we lost defense on the night at that point. Like, and we were still going for it the entire time.
And, you know, that's just a sign of a good unit right there to show that, you know, even if part of it is missing for one reason or another, they just continue on without them.
Yeah, I mean, Coach said in press conference that this team grew more together in that night than he had seen or that he had believed all season so far. Like that was really a critical moment for the group, a gelling moment. He said something really interesting, and I didn't really think about this. He doesn't talk to the team after the game. He's not a manager that gives like those speeches afterwards to like, hey, this is what we did, this is what we learned. He's very much like, you guys are all in your own heads right now. Go ahead and just, you know, decompress, decompartmentalize, and just we'll talk about it on practice the next day. I was really surprised that he said that this performance was so important to him and to the guys that he had to go and have a after game conversation with them, because normally he comes right to us after the game and talks with us, and then sometimes the players are like, hey, it's been like 20 minutes, I'm ready to get out of here, like, you know, you've paid me for the day, I've put in my work. So that was an interesting thing. I didn't realize that Coach maybe doesn't always talk to the the group after the game. You know, it's not like the movies where we see like that inspirational Varsity Blues speech, you know, before, between, and at the end of a game.
Yeah, it makes sense. Different coaches, different styles. It's just unfortunate that the ref was inconsistent on the night. I don't mind seeing a strict ref or even a super lenient ref, like we saw the other day in that Madrid City game. It's just consistency. Because if he was consistent, we would have probably seen a lot more yellow cards go towards Charleston Battery. But, you know, at that point, it is what it is. We cannot control the ref. I just think that if we would have kept 11 men on the field, who knows? We could have snuck a goal at the end. You know, you never know.
Yeah, and you know, if I had to have like an inflection on, I said a second ago that the team showed up well despite being down to 10 men. At the same time, Connor's red card, I don't think that it was yellow card worthy, at least on that foul. But when you are sitting on a yellow, and coach said in the half, like, if you're on a yellow, don't get any more yellows. As the captain, as someone who needs to make sure that we protect those squads and we have all 11 men on the night to see what we can produce and create for fans and just to advance up the table as high as possible, you hate to see your captain get sent off in any capacity, but especially for a yellow card accumulation where he fouled, it was in their defensive third. I mean, I think it was in their penalty area, to be honest.
Pretty close, yeah.
And it's like, what did that get you? Like, was that going to create a goal when you decided to go up? Like, again, I'm not here to bang on a player.
I don't want
to
linger on it for too long. I don't think, though, that like it was too bad of a challenge. It's just this ref was not good.
Right. But if you know the ref's garbage, like, it's not like they didn't go into the halftime locker probably saying, this ref, what's going on? You just want to see some better decision making from any player, but especially the captain. So hopefully this is just a lesson for Connor and for the squad that like we're going to have things that don't go our way, and it's better to continue playing on the yellow and making the decisions where it matters. The only other thing I would say is you know, like, I'd still like to see the wings get a little bit more involved. I think that's part of the conversation on how they unlock this for the next game. We saw a lot of great passing from Clay Holsted and Gabriel Alves on the night. They had the lion's share of touches. They had the most long balls and the most consistency into final third passing. The wings were quiet. The wings were much quieter on the Tampa game, but I don't feel like they've quite gotten engaged as much into the attack or the defense for that matter. So I'd like to see how the likes of Quisera and Turnbull can get unlocked in the next game. I just don't think that they didn't have a bad showing, but they didn't have the best showing on the day.
Statistically, Turnbull had a good game. He put up some good numbers. Quisera was an interesting one. He had the most giveaways on the team of the night, but he also had he also won possession back most times. So, you know, highest dribbles too. He's moving the ball forward. He's losing a lot, but then he has to go win it back. So, yeah, I don't think, but to your point, I don't think we've seen both of our wingbacks have a good or great game at the same time. I feel like it's either we tend to favor one side, maybe whoever seems to have the hot hand for the night. Maybe they pass it to them a little more. Like when you look at the stats, it was fairly balanced this game, but you can see whether they're playing it down the left, middle, or right. And there have been a few games where we've skewed high to the left or high to the right. It was fairly balanced for this one. That was pretty close.
Yeah, I saw someone complain online that like our crossing was not great on the night. Well, yeah, when the water is that wet and it's raining, like you try to put a laser in from 20 yards. Like, I dare you to try that with pressure, with coverage. Like, yeah, we didn't see a good crossing game from Turnbull or Quisera, but like that wasn't, I don't think, the order on the night given the fact that we played so centrally. So, You ready to get into the Riverhounds?
Yeah.
Stop talking about the past and start focusing on the future.
Moving on to the next one.
I'm going to start talking Australian to support Jackson Lee. The future. So Rhode Island FC remains winless after the draw against the Charleston Battery. And we are so winless that we are still one of the four teams that do not have a win yet in the league. That being said, that all could change. Our fortunes could go a different direction this weekend as we welcome another winless team, the Pittsburgh Riverhounds. So Rhode Island FC is coming off of 3 draws and a loss in the last 4 games, whereas Battery are coming in a different direction of 3 losses and a draw. That's a lot of L's. What can you tell us early on before we dive into this game about the Pittsburgh Riverhounds?
So they've all, you know, as you said, they're also winless. They've only scored one goal this season.
Oof.
Yeah, not great. Last place in the East. You know, when you look at it, I think this is a game we should win. But that being said, it's important to kind of not be overconfident. Lest we forget, this team was first place in the East last year. And this is a competitive league. I don't think any of the teams should not respect their opponents. In that regards, you know, it could be a trap game.
It's a trap game.
You know, Yugi could activate his trap card and then we're going to have a bad time. We're still a young team, so you just don't want to go out there overconfident. I think it's important that they take the lessons they learned from this last match and then try and go forward to find balance.
I think because we're winless, I think that this team will actually not, I hope that they know that they need to, the win is so important that they need to treat every opponent as dangerous.
I don't think this team will, but you never know.
If this team was coming in undefeated with like two wins and a draw, then I would say this is a trap game, because then they'd be like, oh, Pittsburgh's at the bottom of the table. We stole two of your best players last year. Like, look at us. Like, you get out of here. You're nothing. I think this is going to be a really good match, a very scrappy match. And I think Rhode Island is like going to be dangerously aware that they need to be able to get the W here, but not at the same time put themselves in a risk where like they're overextended. I mean, again, who knows, right? We're not the players. We're not the coaches, but I don't think they're going into this. And I think you're spot on about how you're saying like, we need to be mindful that this is not a team. Like, this team is, they're not looking great now, but that doesn't mean they're not capable of, you know, really pulling the rug out under any team that doesn't give them the respect that they deserve.
Yeah, like watching, if you go back and watch the highlights against their game against Tampa Bay, the entire highlights is just them creating chances and just no one putting any of them away.
Yeah.
I think Tampa Bay had, what, two chances that night that looked pretty decent?
And Pittsburgh had like 11?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, no, I agree. And again, too, this is a Tampa Bay that just whooped us a week ago, and Pittsburgh was able to contain them and say, No, we're going to tell you how this game is played, that we're going to dominate it with our style. So let's get into this game. Injuries, JJ Williams still out, although he is starting to do some light training. So I think that continues to put us on that now T-minus 4 to 6 week circuit before he could potentially re-enter the team. Did not see Amos practice. I think that there's something more to this. Don't know yet. The club has not come out and said anything. Did not see Grant Stoneman out, so I don't know if that was just a cautionary situation. What's weird is at the press conference, coach had told us Kreefa Yao's injury was a bone bruise, but then when he said Stoneman, he alluded to a hamstring situation, but did not say, he said he could have returned to the game in time, but it was a just cautionary measure. I don't know if Stoneman is going to be in, but if we treat Stoneman with the same likes of Koke Vegas, with how he's been under like hamstring protocol, I would imagine Stoneman will not make it for this game at least. And then the likes of Koke Vegas, for what we've seen, for the videos we've seen this week, for the pictures that the team has shared, he's out in full kit training, and we'll talk about him in a second, but I don't think he is like quote unquote injured anymore. And then, of course, missing for this game this weekend, Connor McGlynn sitting out for the disciplinary action on that red card. So those are the players that won't be making it. Let's talk formations guaranteed to be wrong. Listen.
3-5-2.
Formation, yes. Players in the formation guaranteed to be wrong. So I still have Jackson Lee in the net. I don't think you take, no matter what Koke's health is and if he is ready, two things here. One, you don't pull the hot hand while he's shooting. And Jackson Lee's coming off of a team of the week performance. You know, he's in a position where, you know, he's ready to show that he can do more. Koke is going to be returning to form. I just don't see how you pull Lee at this point in time.
So this is the one out of our lineup here. This is the one I would disagree with, only because we have an Open Cup match coming up. So I would say we'll probably see Koke come into the lineup, because in the Open Cup game, I bet Lee's going to play. Generally, teams will play their secondary keepers in cup competitions. So because that's coming up, I think that will happen. If there was not a Open Cup game, I think that maybe you would give him one more game just as a sign of respect for his last match. But because there's an Open Cup game on Wednesday, I think he's going to bring Koke back into the lineup and Lee will get to start on Tuesday?
Tuesday. Why wouldn't you put Koke in the Tuesday game?
You can do this, but generally when you like start your keeper in the cup competition, you just kind of always play them in those unless they like are injured or something. It's just a weird tradition thing that I feel like might happen.
The only reason I would even entertain that Vegas comes back into the starting 11 is with McGlynn out, we don't have a defined third or tertiary captain for this squad. So if there's no Vegas and no McGlynn, I mean, it's not that important, but we don't have a defined captain to fill the spot for the time being. So I could see that as a precursor to having Vegas return to the starting 11. But man, that doesn't feel good to like, and again, I get it. There's three games, there's Open Cup, but I want, and I'm going to say, is this our first fight? Is this our first fight on the podcast? I'm going to say it's Lee.
I'm just guessing. You know, I could be wrong.
I'm guessing with science. So regardless, so difference of opinions there, but there will be this three-back line. And with Connor McGlynn out, this is where things get interesting. With Stoneman potentially remaining out as he works through whatever this hamstring or muscle issue is, Karifa Yao was technically cleared by Kano's own words at the end of last game. I envision this being a Karifa Yao, Frank Nadarse, and Gabriel Alves three-back line. And instead of having Clay return to that starting right center back role, he fills the need that was vacated in the New Mexico United game where Connor McGlynn wasn't available due to his own injury. And we see a return to Clay Holstead in that right midfielder role. So you have Karifa Yao, Nadarse, Alves in the back. And then you have Turnbull, Holstead, Brito, Ibarra, and Quisera in that midfield line. And again, more of the same with Chico and Fusan up front. Does that line up with you then, just because of the injuries we have and the circumstance?
Yeah. If for some reason Yao is not healthy, I would think maybe Smith would take a spot. Outside of that, like, this is what I imagine they will play.
So I don't know if Smith would, though. Wouldn't it be more Messer? Because isn't Messer the natural center back? I mean, we've not seen Nathan Messer start yet.
You know, he could be playing the right center back, like right back. There's kind of a weird overlap there where it's a similar role. You're just tucked in a little more behind your wing back. If you were thinking Lee will start, if he does, and you've mentioned we don't have another captain, who do you think would be? I my vote would be for Mark Ibarra.
I think it's Ibarra. I've seen some good mix up from Ibarra, not what he does on the pitch, but more of like when fouls get called, he's talking to the ref, he's calming down players. I've seen him keep a pretty cool head on his shoulders at times. So I think Ibarra is the right fit for this work. I question back to you about this formation. We have three games for the first time in 7 days. What does this say to the stretch of games we have this week? Is there anyone that we feel like needs to be rested or rotated out early to make sure that we can not only secure our win here against the Riverhounds, but also get our win in Charlotte before we even start to focus on Las Vegas?
I think in this game, you have to go for it, as we don't have any wins yet. When it comes to the cup competition, generally, that's where you do your heavier rotation. And no disrespect to Charlotte, but they are, you know, a lower tier team. And they've not, you know, they haven't had a terrible start to the season, but they're not doing so hot themselves. So I think that we can look at a heavier rotated squad on Tuesday, and as well as you can have some of those big guns on the bench to kind of maybe, you know, sub in second half or give him maybe 20, 30 minutes towards the end if we need to kill the game off.
So speaking of formations on the Pittsburgh side of things for this game, this is really interesting. We don't see a lot of change in terms of that starting rotation on what the 2023 Riverhounds had. In fact, there's only three players that were not in their original lineup from last year, and that's because two of those players, Mark Ibarra and Chico, play with us now. So you're going to see Eric Dick in the goalkeeper position. Have fun with that on the night supporters group. You're going to see this team line up in a 5-3-2. And that's with the likes of Danny Rivera, Ilal Osamano, Danny Griffin, Luke Biasi, and Junior Itu holding down that defensive shape on the back line. And then you're going to have Robbie Mertz, Jackson Whitey. I should learn how to say these before I have to announce them at the game, by the way. Jackson Whitey or Whitey, Hernando Forbes. And then in your striker core up front, you've got Edward Kizza and Babacar Diagne.
I should say, watching some of the, no shade thrown at any of the announcers, but I don't think some of them do their homework ahead of time. How many times have we heard announcers call him Albert Dikwa?
Yeah, Dikwa's, that's not fun. That's not, I reached out to Chico online and said, hey, like, do you want to be called Chico when you score the goal on the weekend against your former team? Or do you want to be called Albert Dikwa? Because that's important to me. Like, and if I get to be the first one to announce it at home, like, I want to make sure that that's done correctly. He hasn't responded yet, but we have talked a couple of times. So it's going to happen. You know, we'll talk about predictions in a second. So, Jason, this team is the same as last year. You said earlier that this could be a trap because this is a team that needs to be respected. Why is this team struggling so much based on the fact that their starting 11 is mostly intact? Is this an effect of Chico being gone?
I mean, pretty much. I mean, top goal scorer of the league last year. You see how many chances they created. That being said, you know, I don't know anything about Babacar Diagne, but, you know, maybe eventually he'll figure it out. Maybe he'll just have to get a different pair of, you know, shooting boots on. Because clearly this team can create chances. They're just not, you know, getting anyone to put them home. It's possible, too, that maybe he is not... like different strikers will play different ways. They want the balls in different areas. So maybe they are trying to create chances that Dikwa would score. But Babacar Diagne is not the same type of striker. So they kind of have to learn in the same way that we as a team are learning where players want the ball and in what situations they want to receive the ball and where they want the through balls and like long balls to be played. You know, maybe they just need some time to kind of gel the attack.
Either way, this is not the season that head coach Bob Lilly envisioned coming off of a Supporters Shield winning year, at least at the start. And, you know, for the fans, and I think this is important that we kind of get this out there, for those of you that are not aware or are new to the league and to Lilly Ball, as it's called, Lilly Ball is very much that classic American college kind of kick and chase soccer trope that, you know, bypasses the what you see in the modern game of creativity, chance creation, and dribbling, and instead relies more on that physical player athleticism. Most of the men that are going to be in these formations will be behind a midfield that is, you know, it's defensive. You're going to be clogging the lanes, shutting down attacking structure, and that makes for kind of an ugly game when it comes to the quote-unquote beautiful game side of things. This is going to be a physical and scrappy game. That being said, when a team like Pittsburgh does get possession, it's just going to be a, you know, chase and speed down the wings and rely on that physicality. It's reminiscent of like basically the U.S. men's national team up until 2018. So, you know, look for that whole, you know, back and forth pass on the back line, find a probe up the wing, and then just attack. This team doesn't have a lot of stats that they have right now going their way. The physicality, I think, will play to our advantage. We've been looking for a team that wants to line up and be a little bit tougher. So I think, you know, again, because our 3-5-2 at times has the defensive shape of a 5-3-2, I want to almost say that this isn't so much a trap game as like a mirror match. And when you think about like absorbing that pressure and playing between the back lines, I don't think that this is going to be a surprising game. I think it's just going to be which team can out physical the other group. My concern is that if Pittsburgh
could get spicy,
I mean, to a certain extent, my concern is I've seen enough of the Riverhounds last year that when they go up a goal, oh my gosh, they do basically park a bus in front of their back line or their net.
Jose Mourinho's bus right in front of the net.
It can get very, very boring. So, you know, one of the things that has to happen is we have to score first. We have to be able to lead the narrative here. We have to be able to demand that they come to us and they play our style of game. But make no mistake, if we've thought there's a lot of yellow cards that have happened and there's a lot of fouls, I'm hoping that this game is half of the fouls, but they are warranted fouls.
Wait, there's more.
Yeah, I'm hoping that this ref really opens up and allows the game to play on. Speaking of the ref, this is a name. I mean, this is literally a name. Alvin Oliva. I could read it five times and I'd never get it. I have to say this name and the announcer too. Alvin Oliva. He hasn't called in USL Championship games this year yet. He's been down in the MLS Next Pro, and he's only called two or three games for the season so far. Again, that's not to say as a detriment that he doesn't have the ability, and he has called championship games last year and the year before that, but he hasn't been called up to the big league, so to speak, yet this season. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of game he calls. He's averaging 5 yellow cards a game, but that's on a game where he had 1 yellow card, another card, a game where he had 1 yellow card, and then a game where he had 7 yellow cards with 1 red card. So it's like, again, did he already have his Carnacion moment? I don't know, but we'll see what he delivers on the night to see how this game could work for us.
Yeah, should be interesting to see how that pans out for us. Hopefully we're more of the towards the 1 yellow card game and not that 7 one that he had.
I mean, listen, I know yellow card accrual is a very real thing for this club. I am more worried about a ref consistently calling for both sides. So if we're both going to get physical on the night, as long as it's equal, that's all I care about. But this could be a very scrappy game in a positive, and it could be a very scrappy game in a negative sense as well. So this will be exciting to watch. And plus, this is the likes of Ibarra and Dequa getting a return to their former glory. And so there's probably a lot on their minds and a lot on their kind of shoulders to say, like, hey, we are now a different group. We're on a different team, and we want to show that we were the reason you were so good last year by beating you. So lots of pressure there. Listen, when I went to go do the players to watch column, it was bad. I mean, you alluded to it earlier. There's only one player that scored a goal. There's only one goal on the season for this team. They're a sieve. They've been leaking goals left and right. All of their stats are kind of in the bad indicator columns. They don't lead in anything except for tackles, back possession, and back passes. So and by the way, in tackles, like, that's their highest rated one, but we're still number one in tackles. That's actually the one column Rhode Island FC is winning this year, is tackle conversion. Nice.
Most tackles.
So call that for what you want. But this team is not leading in any way, shape, or form. That being said, you know, I kind of just picked the players based on their ratings or what I saw in the most recent performance. And I got to give credit. This is mostly a defensive call out here, which is it's going to kind of challenge the likes of Chico and Fusan to find ways to score goals against the likes of this group. But center back Daniel Griffin, he's a journeyman. He's a veteran for the Riverhounds. He's that central spine that's controlling their back line. And he has some of the best stats on last year and this year. So he's someone to not, you know, look at lightly when trying to get behind lines and score goals. Likewise, defender Luke Biasi, you know, he's kind of like a light version of Griffin. Some of the same stats, some of the same expectations. And then newcomer goalkeeper Eric Dick, he's been under siege. And while he's conceded 6 goals, like, I don't think that is just the performance on his. Just like we talked about with Jackson Lee at the Tampa Bay game.
Yeah, team effort.
Right. And he's averaging 3 saves a match for 4 games already. So it's not like he's not putting in defensive work. It's just not going his favor based on the rest of what Lily Ball has been accomplishing for this team so far. But in terms of attacking threat, with Chico not on this team, I haven't seen the midfield and Kizza unlock something yet. Hopefully they don't figure that out in this game against us, but I think
they can figure it out next week.
Exactly. So I think it's just more of how do we find ways to unlock this defense and score goals, hopefully 3 goals, so I can announce it, you know, multiple times on the night for fans at Burns Stadium.
Yeah, maybe this can be their Tampa Bay Rowdy moment, you know. We can beat them so bad that they have to go back home and be like, guys, we need to figure this out.
You know, if we defeat the basement team, though, our power ranking only goes up by like half a point.
I don't care about power ranking. I just need to get that win monkey off the back, you know, so we can kind of move forward.
Exactly. So what does Rhode Island FC have to get right this game?
Chico is hungry. That man needs crosses. 3 goals in 4 games. I mean, I think we can get that number higher. So, I mean, he even said in the post-match interview, you know, he wants to get some crosses. This last game, weather was, let's just say, awful. So, you know, understandable maybe. And then trying to balance the defense, we just didn't get enough in. And speaking of which, I also think that while this last match was impressive, we shouldn't be doing that every match. It's important that the wingbacks start to come back more, but it's also about learning to see how the game flows. And if we are in the ascension, they need to push forward and we need to get those crosses. So how do we find the balance of defending like a unit very well, like we did in the last match, but also maybe kind of also going all out attack to a certain extent, like we have in the first three? I think if we can find that balance, this team will be explosive and dangerous.
Yeah, I think you're spot on with the balance part. Although I would say it's a little bit more than just like finding the nuance in the middle of the game. I think that they still need to come out early, you know, punch the shark in the nose, go up early as they've demonstrated in both the Tampa and Monterey Bay games, and then make an adjustment tactic wise after they go up. And I'm not saying park the bus, but you can clearly see that we didn't really change the order of the day once we went up early. We continued that high line press with a little bit of disconnect from the defense. If we go up a goal, you know, change the shape, change the strategy to where like, hey, let the game, again, let us control the game. We don't need to continue to repeat the process over and over to try to yield another goal, because if that ends up working against us and scoring against us, then we didn't really accomplish anything. So I don't want it to be like, okay, we scored a goal, park that bus. No, but we can show that we've been able to do the offense and the defensive side. Let's just thread the needle and have a complete 90 at this point. And then the other thing, we haven't really talked about it, but I want to say, like, especially with this week, with three games, I really hope Kano can leverage the subs a little bit better. And I don't mean it in any kind of like mismanagement way. I haven't seen our subs come on and really change the game in the last 2 weeks. Like, you know, when we looked at what Doyle did on game one, that was incredible, right? With the likes of Sadie and him coming in, creating speed. Like, that was real game changing. I feel like ever since then, we've been just making like, okay, these players are gassed, hold down their position and, you know, just get the job done, close out the game, but not really contribute in a game changing way. Some of these players could be playing north of 250 minutes this week coming up. Making tactical subs at the right time, maybe a little bit earlier, keeping our players healthy and rotation, I think that that's going to be the key on the week, not just for the Riverhounds, but for the Charlotte Independents and then Las Vegas Lights after that. You know, this will be a testament to how far our players can go in endurance.
I think that's fair. There's been some issues with injuries already. So, you know, when it comes to impact subs, I don't know if we're going to find anything like that. But in terms of trying to keep the team healthy and, you know, resist more injuries, you know, I hope that, you know, we are using as many of the subs as we can to kind of, you know, hopefully keep the rest of everyone on the sidelines and available.
Final score prediction. I'm still in the lead. I'm going 3-1 and I'm going to have to announce three goals.
I think we're going to win 2-0.
Okay, there you have it. I think this is the first time we've both committed to a win since game one, yeah?
Yeah.
So that means we tie 3-3, right?
You know, I mean, if worst case scenario, if that happened, I imagine that would be a very exciting match. So I wouldn't be, as long as we don't lose, you know?
Yeah, we can't lose. Like, that is the truth. And then we'll have the 0-0, the 1-1, the 2-2, then the 3-3. So,
oh, it's just like a graph. It's just going to keep going up and down.
So what's in the mailbag?
All right. Kevin wants to know, how do you feel about the in-game broadcast? What would you do differently to bring more flair to the game experience?
This is just a trap question. He knows I'm announcing this week, so he's asking me to tip my hand. Like I said, my goal is to just give soccer expertise to the ability that I can and make it a fun and enjoyable in-day performance. And for those of you that know me, you know, getting to laugh at my expenses, I struggle through something that I've never professionally done before. So Shadow Wolf on Twitter writes it. He wrote in like six paragraphs. I had to paraphrase it down. I had to bring it down because Shadow Wolf, you can only ask one question. You can't ask like seven. Not really a question. Just a shout out to y'all. If a silly German U.S. soccer nerd, cough me, never misses an episode, you're doing a mighty fine job. Are you happy about the draws, which were not losses, like Monterey Bay could have been, or upset that you should have won them?
No, I'm not disappointed about them. I think overall, I'm just glad to have soccer here, and I'm really excited. I see a lot of potential in the team, so I'm still willing to give them time to kind of get everything sorted out. before we start to be concerned. And then Evan R. here wants to know, if we put Brito out wide and have Doyle up top, does that fix our offense?
No. And the reason why is Doyle's not the solution that interchanges with Brito. Those are two different players. You're talking about a central mid to a winger. If you're saying, do we drop one of the central midfielders for a winger opportunity, I don't know that Doyle's the answer. I would like to see Sadie come first. He's got more speed than Doyle. That would be my take immediately. Taras asks, who do you think should take penalties for Rhode Island FC? And do you see an improvement from game to game?
I think Chico should, but I'm also not familiar with any of the team's penalty taking abilities. So that kind of remains to be seen. And so far, I do think that we've improved from game to game. Maybe not in all the same areas, but so far, I'm happy with what I'm seeing from the team. And then Jed T wants to know, when is Koke back?
I feel like I'm getting all the easy questions tonight. I just get to say no, soon.
I mean, you organized these, so you must have given them to yourself.
I actually just copied them in the order that I got them. Jed, Koke is technically available, but it could be a defensive measure just to give him an extra week. Jason and I both think that he, like we said earlier, he is ready to return. It's just a difference of opinion on, does he return for the Riverhounds game or does he enter back in against that Charlotte Independence game? I think it could go either way. And it could just be come down to day to day, like game of if Koke is feeling ready to return or if you keep Lee in. Zach Du asks, what are Connor Smith's halftime speeches like? And does he make enough halftime adjustments in your opinion? We've had 1-0 leads and we have not come away with 3 points in either of the two games where we had them. Only 4 teams have a worse goal differential. Who's more to blame for this and which should we be more panicked about?
Well, I've never been in the locker room, so I don't know what his halftime speeches are like. When it comes to halftime adjustments, generally you only make those if you're getting like absolutely thumped or something's really, really wrong. The reality is this team has played 4 games, so we really do have to give it time. You know, I don't really think that there's an issue. I don't think we should be panicked. Like I mentioned in the last game, I think we do need to give this team a little bit of time. You know, if we're 10 games in and we still don't have a win, then yeah, we should be concerned. But at this point, you know, it's still early. Andrew H. wants to know, of the players that we haven't seen on the pitch yet, JJ, Messer, Amos, who are you most excited for?
Should we punish Andrew publicly and say that he also didn't mention Kevin Vang on this or Nate Silvera, our two Rhode Island boys? I mean, listen, at the end of the day, the answer is obviously JJ Williams. And that's only because when you think about how this team was designed, I don't think that they anticipated JJ starting the season with this injury. He seems like he's the missing piece offensively to connect the midfield and the forwards. As kind of like that hold up center forward, not a cam, but like one of those forwards that drops back deep, collects a ball and then distributes it out and then comes back up as the, you know, it's a give and go. And then suddenly he's in the air knocking a ball down. We have not seen very good crossing yet where players are making connections to balls in the air. And that could be an argument about Quisera and Turnbull and the likes of feeding good balls in. But at the same time, you know, I think that we're going to see that unlocked more once we see JJ return. So I'm really excited. I mean, again, JJ had, I think, 12 goals on the season last year. And so that's a huge piece to be missing in your arsenal. So really excited when he's able to return. That being said, Rhode Island FC is set to host the Pittsburgh Riverhounds this Saturday, April 13th at 7:30 p.m. Again, as a reminder, gates open to the parking lot 3 hours in advance at 4:30. The weather seems much more favorable for this matchup, no rain, and a little bit warmer, so I anticipate lots of fans to return. Again, it was a sizable, almost 4,000 attendance for fans last week in the rain, so if 4,000 can do it in the rain, I expect all of you to show up for a great night of soccer, and we're just really excited to see which one of these teams is going to get their first win on the season.
You can come and join RAFC and Defiance 1636 at Moniker Brewing as Rhode Island FC plays the Charlotte Independence on Tuesday, April 16th at 7 p.m. If you can't come join in person, you can watch the live streams for free at ussoccer.com.
Man, Moniker is going to be a blast. They've got great beer. They've got a great soccer environment there. I watched the World Cup last year, and it was just in a, it was, or not last year, but gosh, it's been so long now.
2 years.
2 years ago. Wow. I watched it 2 years ago, and it was just an incredible, like, that's a guy, that's an organization that really cares about soccer. So definitely come out for one with Moniker and the Defiance and Rhode Island FC for that. And then finally, Rhode Island FC will complete its 30-game circuit, traveling away to the City of Sin to square off against the Las Vegas Lights on Saturday, April 20th at 8 p.m. This game will be available only on ESPN+, so you can come and, or you can watch that game from the pleasure of your home, or you can come and join the supporters group at the Guild for their watch party in Pawtucket. No word yet on the Rhode Island FC official watch parties, as that's like three games away right now. So that is not, like, they're focused completely on this game this weekend with the Riverhounds. So more to come there.
All right, guys, let's wrap this up. So you can find us online on Twitter, Threads, and TikTok at RAFC Podcast, on Instagram at Racing Anchor. And there's that website, www.racinganchorpodcast.com.
Yeah, don't forget to vote for us on Rhode Island Monthly. We'll send the link out this week, so if you want to wait for that to come, we'll give it to you then. And also, just don't forget to rate us wherever you do like to listen. We always continue to appreciate your love and support, and can't thank you guys enough for everything that you do to encourage and to give us the feedback that we get. So, anchors up, everyone.
Anchors up.